The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Wells Bennett. We continue this week with our coverage of the military commissions at Guantanamo Bay. In January, we spoke to Brigadier General Mark Martins, the commission's chief prosecutor, on his recommendation to withdraw certain charges against the defendants accused in the 9/11 case. This week, I spoke to Commander Walter Ruiz, a lawyer for one of the men accused in that case, Mustafa al-Halsawi. Let's start with the commissions, just generally, before we talk about the case on which you've been working. Congress has approved these tribunals twice. We know they emphatically support them. The Obama administration said it supports them under certain circumstances and touts the reforms in the 2009 statute as making them fair. Doubtless you're aware of General Martin's very public efforts at explaining and advocating for commissions, their procedures. How are they wrong?
Well, I mean, if you're comparing them to where we started and where we are, certainly I think I would be hard-pressed to say that there hasn't been some progress, right? But when the bar starts that low, it's difficult to say that we haven't come up to some degree. They're wrong on many different aspects. If you're talking about structural and what the 2009 Military Commissions Act lacks in structural, in terms of rights, like you would see in federal court, rights that you would see in our state courts, we can start, for example, with one of the rules that we've been talking about is the derivative evidence for torture. And the fact of the matter is that you've seen a great push from General Martins to say that evidence from torture is not admissible. Evidence from torture will not be used. But what never really gets talked about is the fact that there is a very explicit provision in the Military Commissions Act that allows for evidence that is obtained as derivative from torture. So if it is derived from torture, it can still be admitted under certain circumstances. That would involve a fact-finding process from the judge in terms of reliability, in terms of whether it's in the interest of justice. And those types of standards are the types of standards that give somebody the ability to decide some very inconsistent things from one court to the next court. So that's important. That's in my view one of the main defects in the current Military Commissions Act. And what General Martins, I know, has said a number of times repeatedly is we're not going to use evidence that is obtained from torture. We're not going to use evidence obtained from torture in the prosecution. We're not going to use statements that have been derived from torture. The implication is that there's going to be evidence that's used from clean teams, the people who came in after presumably there had been these techniques that were employed that we can't really talk much about. But that's the implication. What I see as being fundamentally wrong with that is that you're taking the focus off what's fundamentally wrong with the legislation. And I've tried to think about how to articulate that in a way that makes sense. And the way I think it makes sense is you just have to look at the essence of the law. And this is an imperfect analogy, but if tomorrow Congress were to pass a law or pass multiple laws that said, look, slave labor is going to be allowed, and it's going to be allowed for harvesting the crops under certain circumstances, and they passed the law they put it on the books. And then you have some person from a farm talking about the effect of the law, and what they say is, look, we're not going to use slave labor. We're not going to use it to harvest our crops. We're not going to use it to harvest our fields. That's fine. But it doesn't erase the fact that you have a law on the books that's not only morally deficient, but is completely inconsistent with any justice system that we have, whether it's the federal system, whether it's the state system. The fact of the matter is we have a law on the books that's unlike any other law that allows derivative evidence from torture. The second question with that is, where does torture stop and where does it begin? Right? Where does it begin? Where does it stop? It's very difficult, I think, to draw this line in the sand as to where the torturing of a person stops and what those effects lead to, and what kind of evidence can then be admissible. And I think for that you have to probably engage in some type of mental gymnastics. For instance, if you were transported to a third world country and you were imprisoned in that country, and you had to endure some of the things that publicly have been discussed in terms of some of these prisoners and the things that they endured. And then at some point you had additional captors or additional investigators come in and continue to interrogate you, but they told you they were from a different institution, from a different part of the government. I think that that's probably the closest that we could get to seeing what the fundamental problem is with that distinction, is that I think while it sounds good when we talk about it, in reality, in blood and flesh, it's probably not a very realistic thing to think about. And to say that there's a stopping point, there's a clinching period, and then an additional team comes in and somehow all of the effects of that are going to be washed away, I think it's pretty much a fiction. So I think those two things are what I would say in terms of that particular provision. There are additional problems with the Military Commissions Act. Fundamentally, we have Rule 703, and Rule 703 is what I refer to as the show us your playbook, and we won't show you ours. I've referred to that a number of times in court when we talked about the New England Patriots and the St. Louis Rams analogy, where the Super Bowl, I think it was called Spygate, where the St. Louis Rams complained because New England Patriots were supposedly videotaping their practices and they're running their plays, and of course that would give them an unfair advantage in the ensuing game. And I think New England, ended up winning the Super Bowl, from what I recall. And whether that had an effect or not, I'm not sure. But in reality, that's what happens with us and with our witness requests. And what we're asked to do under this scheme, in this system, is to provide the prosecution with the first run at vetoing our defense witnesses. And I think we've lost count by now, but I think collectively we've probably requested somewhere in the neighborhood of 30, 40, maybe 50 witnesses. And I do not think we've gotten in. Approved by the prosecution, and that is exactly what has to happen. The prosecution has to approve our witness requests and find them that they are relevant, that they're material to what we're calling them for. And so,
let me stop you there. Wouldn't a proponent of the system say, well, don't you get judicial review of that decision?
You do.
You can go to the military judge and say, no, we need these people.
Absolutely, and that's in fact what the prosecution has said, but I think we would be fine with that scheme if we had to simply go to the court and articulate to the court why we needed a witness. We are getting to do that in some respects with the expert witnesses,
mm-hmm.
where we get to make our case to the court and at least preserve that confidentiality and that privilege. Mm-hmm. But if that is the case, and if in fact we do have judicial review, why do we need to filter it through the opposing players? Why do we need to filter that through our opponent, the advocates that are there for the explicit purpose of opposing our function, which is to defend the defendants? It makes no sense. It is quite clearly an advantage to the prosecution, not only to know who the witnesses are, but to be able to know what we think that they would be relevant and material to. There's no other system where that's the way things work. It doesn't work that way in state court. It doesn't work that way in federal court.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's clearly a deficiency of this system. And I think it's one that for us is very important in terms of how we operate. The other issues we talked about before is you have deficiencies with respect to hearsay evidence, the admissibility of hearsay, the admissibility of statements. In terms of coerced statements, you have a lower standard of admissibility. It's not voluntariness. Emerald McDonald, when he went to testify before Congress, one of the things that
By this, yeah, just to stop you, you mean the former convening authority for the military commissions?
Correct. And it's the convening authority, as you know, is the approving official for much of our funding for expert witnesses. When he went before Congress, he advocated against a voluntariness standard for the admissibility of statements and in support of a lower standard of admissibility. That's, in fact, what we have now, where the judge can make a reliability determination, maybe take in some totality of the circumstances, but it's a watered-down version of admissibility of evidence. So you have those structural problems with the military commissions, and I just picked a few of the rules to highlight that. Of course, we don't have what you have in the federal system, which is a grand jury. We don't have what you have in the court-martial system, which is called an Article 32 hearing, which is the same as a preliminary hearing, which is basically the first run of the evidence, where the defense has an opportunity to, well, not in the grand jury, but in the Article 32, the defense has an opportunity to preview what the government's case is as a probable cause determination and go through that process.
Well, wouldn't someone with, you know, I wouldn't want to characterize it anyway, but someone with, just sort of looking at the 2009 statute, they would say that, well, you can go to the convening authority before charges are referred and say, you know, mitigation submissions or make legal challenges at that phase. I mean, can't, for example, the defense can say, look, you know, we don't think the evidence is really there, or there was misconduct in preparation of this case that weighs against doing. I mean, can't you say those things to, I mean, it's no longer McDonald, but if you were in that phase again, you know, it's a McDonald successor.
Can a proponent of that, of
yes.
the, absolutely, they can absolutely say that, and they have said that. And to really answer that, you have to get a little bit deeper into how the system actually works. But one of the things you said is, can't you point out that the evidence shows otherwise? Well, one of the exchanges we had when I questioned Admiral McDonald, the former convening authority, was how much time he'd had to review. I think it was around 3,000 pages worth of documents that were provided to him by the prosecution in making a determination. We never received any of that evidence in time to make any type of comment on the evidence to the convening authority. The deadline came, the deadline went, and we didn't receive any type of discovery until well after that had happened. So we didn't have any evidence that we could comment on to the convening authority. In practice and in theory, we should have the opportunity to do that. But what actually happened was not that, and it didn't happen for a number of reasons. Number one was the timeline that was set by the convening authority, Admiral McDonnell, was completely unrealistic. And that's going to be the subject of future litigation, so I'm not going to go too much further into that. But the timeline was very unrealistic, and none of the experts on the teams that were hired for the explicit purpose of helping us to provide him with that type of information were clear. And at the time, we were operating under a scheme where nobody could speak to our client unless they were properly cleared, because everything that came out of our client's mouth was supposed to be classified. And so the expert, the mitigation expert that you've heard so much about, is basically the capital litigator's right-hand person, the one who's supposed to go in, flesh out these details, be able to help put together this kind of information for some decision maker, and then provide it to him. That's the way it's supposed to work. And that's not how it worked, because they weren't cleared. The timeline was incredibly short. In my case, in Mr. Ansawi's case, we didn't have a translator. And I know that you've heard that a number of times. So,
just to put a fine point, you didn't have any translator, or you had some translator you couldn't work with, or that something like that, or?
No, I did not have a team dedicated Arabic translator on my team, or that was properly cleared to go in and talk to Mr. Hassan. And there's been some questions about who do we have in the office that were Arabic translators. We have Arabic translators in our office who are documents translators. They don't have the right clearance to go in and speak with the client. They didn't have it back then because they were required to be cleared at a TS, SCI level, because everything that came out of our client's mouth was considered to be classified. So you've seen the prosecution conflating the two and saying they could have used one of those translators. That's absolutely incorrect. It was impossible to do, even from a classification perspective. They couldn't have even stepped into the room to do that. So that's that point. And we're gonna flesh that out, I think, a lot more, and hopefully a lot more clearly in the upcoming litigation. So while the process should provide for an opportunity to do that, while there is a rule that governs how that information should be reviewed, weighed, and then a determination been made. That has never happened. It didn't happen. And that's where the unlawful influence issue starts to rear its head. That's where we have to start looking at why the decisions were made that they were made and how they were made in terms of setting timelines, in terms of not providing the adequate resources, and to peel that back and see exactly why a process that in theory is supposed to provide an opportunity for us to do our work the way it ought to be done in the capital litigation wasn't really done. So you have the structural issues. You, of course, have why is the military commission wrong? I think the military commissions were also created explicitly for convictions and to be an easier method to a conviction with less procedural protections. And while you've seen somewhat of an evolution in the procedural protections that we have, and I think you have to say that we have, for one, we've gotten the learned counsel provision of put into the 2009 military commission.
You mean the appointment of civilian death penalty qualified counsel?
Or just capital qualified counsel, because I'm not civilian, but I'm capital qualified.
I see.
And that became a matter of right. I think that was a very good step in the right direction, to give credit where credit is due. However, we took two or three or four steps back in the opposite direction when the actual people on the ground in charge of carrying out this process and providing those counsel the opportunity to do their job basically set up a no-win scenario. And so while in theory that was a good thing in terms of having capital qualified counsel, what they really did and what they really have done in practice is tied our hands behind our back by the way that they've set up the timelines, by the way the classification issues have become problematic. And so it's one thing to say you've got certain at least idealistic or maybe rights on paper that you could exercise or even resources when we talk about capital qualified counsel. It's another thing to say that in everyday defense and everyday advancement of a cause that we can actually do what we've been asked to do, and that's clearly not the case. And then, of course, you've seen things that are completely out of our control, and when I say our control of the defense, and even though we get blamed for a lot of these things, is intrusion into the courtroom by third parties.
Well, I guess, yeah, I mean, I'll cut you off there just because we're talking generally, we're moving into the case. So let's talk about the case.
Mm-hmm.
You're representing Mustafa al-Hasawi, one of the five men accused of this incredibly heinous crime. What is it like defending this case? Your personal experiences, where the case is procedurally, as you alluded to some bumps the case has experienced recently. You know, we've read about third party monitoring events, some of them having a censorship button, the disappearance of defense work product from computers. You mentioned one filing, or the defense did in one filing, and also the disclosure of some confidential materials, the handling of written communications. Just give us a lay of the land of what it's like right now to be defending this case on behalf of your client.
You know, one of the biggest problems when talking about Guantanamo is there's just so much to talk about, right? it's not. I'm not wanting for lack of material or issues to discuss. Before I go there, just real quickly, I'll tell you my quick background so you know my point of reference when I discuss the case. And I started off as an active duty officer, did 4 years in the regular court-martial system, defending military soldiers, men and women in the military, of criminal offenses within the military. Then I went and did this work as state public defender, did capital litigation in the state of Florida, and did that round before I went to federal court as a federal defender and worked in the federal courts in Florida. Now I'm here. And I tell you that because I think it's significant that I've worked in every criminal justice system I think that we have, state, federal, and also in the regular court-martial system that you hear references from time to time. Having said that, what I can tell you is that this experience is unlike any experience that I've ever had in any of those systems. It's by far the greatest challenge professionally that I've faced. I think it's also the greatest challenge I faced personally, on a personal level, in terms of the kind of issues that I've had to learn, the kinds of boundaries that I've had to come closer to. You're talking international law. You're talking a brand new system of justice that's been created for this. You're talking capital litigation meets national security. So you have this perfect storm of all kinds of different disciplines that you have to become incredibly competent. In my prior practice, I didn't do a whole lot of international law. Now I'm looking at Article 5, I'm looking at the Geneva Conventions. I'm looking at where that intersects with our detention policies and the detention policies that we've given to these men. So it's extremely challenging on many levels. Representing Mr. Al-Hassawi has been an evolution, personally and professionally. I would dare say that I had very little in common with the man before, and I still really don't. I've learned a lot just about the differences in our views and our viewpoints in the world. I didn't really spend a whole lot of time looking at what was happening in the Middle East or the politics of the Middle East or the grievances of the Middle East as they affected or as they intersected with our foreign policy. I've had to learn a lot more of that in order to, I think, do my job more effectively. I certainly have had to look at this system on a number of different evolutions and so that I can critique it, I think, fairly and honestly. I think there are positive aspects of what we're doing, but not in this system. And I think a lot of people are coming now to recognize that the system is an evolution and just political. It's a political evolution. It's a political animal. It was created for a very explicit purpose and very politically motivated. And that just doesn't work. So in terms of the actual case itself, some days we say, look, this is everything that's wrong with the way we should be approaching a criminal justice system, right? We have certain ideals, certain benchmarks that have been set forth in our system of justice for a very long time, some ideals that we believe in, ideals that that we think are important. And as officers, we sign an oath. We swear to an oath, right? And I've talked about that before, and that is meaningful. And that oath is to give meaning to those rights in the Constitution, in the Declaration of Independence, our Bill of Rights. And, of course, you then have the question of whether that should apply to these men or not, whether it should apply when we're not on actual United States soil, and all of those different questions. But at the end of the day, I think that since we are all men and women in uniform, those of us who are in uniform, the vast majority of the system is run by people who are either in uniform or were in uniform or are now civil servants. And, of course, we have a few civilians that now have been brought into the system. But at the end of the day, everyone running this is an American citizen. And it's an American institution. And what drives many of us is a real belief that we need to bring back the legitimacy of what our laws stand for and bring back the legitimacy also in some respects of the military system. Somebody who has been in the military system for a while, in the court-martial system, I can tell you that there is a feeling amongst many of us in the defense side and also some of the prosecutors that I think have come out and been very outspoken about the problems with the military commissions, that the military system itself has been dragged through the mud. Unwittingly, as an unwitting participant. In essence, it's almost like somebody lit the bag of poop and dropped it on the military's door and said, you handle this, right? I mean, for lack of a better analogy, I think there are a lot of people who feel that way, that somebody lit this thing on fire and then handed it to military system or the Department of Defense to handle, whether it's Guantanamo or the military commissions. And what they did was really diminish the military commissions, the military system of justice that we typically have, which has a lot higher bars. And now everyone you talk to really equates military justice with the military commissions and everything that's wrong with the military commissions. So that's disconcerting, it's upsetting, and it's problematic. And I think that what tries to bring that back is the effort you see from all the men and women in uniform who are opposing that, who are trying to bring it back to, I think, where it needs to be.
You mentioned some of the day-to-day burdens. I think you were alluding to some of the events that happened in court when a button is pushed after, and ordinarily that was only the judge's prerogative to do, and it very much exercised the judge. And I mentioned earlier some of the other kind of things that are going on with defense counsel in court. Can you just give us a sense of what's going on these days in the case with those issues?
Well, these things are frustrating to us, of course, because it affects our relationship with the clients. It affects our ability to prepare. And it affects our ability to sometimes focus on issues we want to focus on. And so it is a burden. It is a problem. It is something that we look at and say, it shouldn't be this way. At the same time, I think many of us would candidly say that, and some have said, it's a gift that keeps on giving, right? The problems that come up that are completely out of our control, such as some outside entity pushing a button that censors the court, even unbeknownst to the judge, is not something that was a creation from the defense counsel. Certainly we could not conceive that, and we tried everything that we could to try and get at the heart of that. But at the same time, it is an issue that we've litigated. And we've had to litigate because it affects our ability to meet with our clients in privacy and privileges and confidentiality and the things that are the benchmark of the attorney-client relationship. From a litigation standpoint in a capital case, that's an issue that we now have for appeal, right? So while it is frustrating, while it shouldn't happen, it is something that at the end of the day creates a legal issue that's very important for us and that may create a lot of problems later on for an appellate court or in an appellate court. The same thing when you talk about the recent discussion that we've had about the emails and the communications from defense.
Just briefly, exactly what happened?
Well, as I understand it, what happened was there is a collateral action in the Alkosi case. Mr. Alkosi has since been repatriated to the Sudan. And the main issue in that case is whether the appellate waiver was obtained properly or was not obtained properly, and there was a challenge to that. In the process of that, at some point, the court ordered the prosecution to provide evidence of certain acts, whether there was any communications that were created. At some point along the process, searches were made of the servers and different emails. And all I know is at the end of the day, over 500,000 emails were sent to the prosecution. And many of those emails contain emails from defense attorneys. My particular case, Commander Suzanne Lachelier, was a counsel that was on Alkosi and who has also been supporting our defense efforts in Mr. Osawi's case, which is why we filed a motion to intervene in the appellate court. But essentially, the prosecution ended up with emails that contain defense communications. Now, one of the things that I've heard is pushback from the prosecution. And they've taken a pretty aggressive stance to try to rebut these allegations, I guess for lack of a better term, that they've come into possession of defense emails, is that they've never seen a single email that was provided to them in the course of that search. And you only have to go as far as Captain Ed White's. Captain Ed White is, I believe, the chief appellate counsel for the office of the chief prosecutor. And Captain Ed White, in one of his filings before the court, clearly says, I opened a number of the emails. One of the emails included communications. It only contained communications from defense counsel. So I know we've heard pushback, and I've heard pushback from the prosecution, very definitive pushback, saying not a single communication was ever looked at unless the pleading from the chief appellate counsel and the military commission's chief prosecutor's office is incorrect. That's not right. Now, what's the problem with that? I've always used the word compromise when I refer to this particular incident because I see it as a compromise of information. Anytime an opponent ends up with defense information or prosecution information, that information is potentially compromised. There is no reason why I should have prosecutorial communications in my possession. There is no reason why the prosecution should have defense communications, and there is no reason why they should really open them, even when, as I understand the pleading from Captain White, it was very clear that was a defense communication or it's a team on it or something along those lines. Bottom line is, it's indisputable that over 500,000 emails were provided to the prosecution and that some of those emails, I don't know how many because I haven't seen them, I haven't looked at them, contained communications that were defense communications. That's a problem. And it goes back to what I was telling you in terms of my background. Never in my 18-plus year career in any system that I've ever worked in, have I ever seen a situation where you had that kind of problem where the prosecution suddenly ends up with 500,000 emails on their lap, some of which contain defense communications. I think the problem with that is that it shows really bad judgment at best. It's somewhere along the line, the people who were conducting the searches were getting directives on what types of searches to conduct. And people who were in those positions, if they were experienced and understood what they were likely to get, should not have gone down that road. And I think that's
so
one of
you,
the...
So you suspect just a garden variety screw-up?
Oh, I certainly don't... I don't think that there was any malfeasance or people set out to hack our communications. I've seen nothing along those lines. What I've seen is a real reluctance to simply acknowledge that it was bad judgment and that they should not have had possession of our emails. And to just simply say, look, that's what happened. That's what we did. We shouldn't have had them. And that's the end of the day. But at the end of the day, they ended up with our communications, and they shouldn't have had. The other problem that we've had, and this has been very clearly documented by our IT folks, is, and the Chief Defense Counsel has been pushing this issue very, very hard, is we lost data. We simply lost amounts of data that had our work product in it. And the real challenge for us then is to go back and find what's lost. A lot of times we don't find out what's lost until you go looking for it and it's not there, right? So many times you don't know what's lost unless you go looking for it. And now you take that and you multiply it through an entire office and you have to ask, well, how much stuff has been lost? So we're dealing with those challenges. Right now we're not really supposed to use our computers for attorney-client privilege communications amongst teams. We have external hard drives that we have to use, but we have a limited number of those. So what you really have to do is you have to save it onto one hard drive, you unplug it, you have to take it to the next person, run it down the hallway, give it to them, you know, tag them, and give them the hard drive. But if you're not in the office, that's a problem.
Yes, the question then becomes, you know, you're litigating these in court now, these things about, you know, the sanctity of your communications or things like that. I suppose, apart from the practical burden, the question is whether you're getting, do you feel like you're making progress in, say, investigating how safe your communications are and kind of finding a remedy for those?
I think we're trying to make progress. I think the Chief Defense Counsel is trying to find a way to maybe section off our servers and the way that our servers work. But, I mean, there's so many issues. We found one of our analysts was clearly being monitored when he was looking at open source information. Downloading open source information had been declassified. And
when you say monitored, how monitored and by whom?
Well, his computer was being monitored. I can't tell you the technical aspects of it. And I can't even tell you who it was because it was a phone call that he got basically saying, why are you looking at that? What's going on with that? The Al-Nashiri team, I think, filed a motion to litigate that. In doing that, they asked for my team analyst to do a declaration. One of the contractors then interceded essentially to say, you can't give declarations on behalf of the defense unless they're cleared by our general counsel. So you have all these, when you talk about progress, right, it's very difficult to know who's monitoring you. It's very difficult to even know who they are. There is very little accountability for that in terms of you saw a perfect example of that when the button was pushed in court, right? Who did it? Where are they? We can't tell you. That's what we get when we have an incident like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, you don't really need to know. So progress, you've seen the docket. We were talking about the docket. Whatever, 160 plus motions in it. We've heard very few. Most of them have been things on very minor issues.
One more question about the case. A recurring theme thus far in the case, apart from issues of defense communications and things like that, has been the statements by detainees and the strictures put on detainees' statements. Defense counsel, human rights groups have put a lot of emphasis on, for example, the detainees' accounts of their experiences during interrogation. This was litigated in the context of the protective order, for example. Some of it's still going on. I'd just like to hear a little bit more from you about that, because I think from a legal standpoint, there's some question as to, you know, what's the legal connection between those state, you know, those experiences and those accounts and the legal case against your client? Is the idea, for example, that this was government misconduct and they're going to talk about that misconduct, it's going to call into question the legitimacy of the whole thing and make it go away, or is it good to mitigation? I'd like to hear her thoughts, if you could.
I think the circumstances under which the statements were obtained certainly colors potentially the admissibility of the statements, for one, right? I mean, information that was obtained and the manner in which that information was obtained. So you have potentially an issue to litigate in terms of the admissibility of the statements based on what circumstances they were extracted under.
To the extent someone seeks to introduce them, of course.
To the extent they seek to introduce them. The second aspect of that is, I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head, is you have a capital prosecution. And when you have a capital prosecution, it's a game changer in terms of rules. You have heightened due process. You have a different set of rules that you really play by. And that's because our Supreme Court has determined that when a government sets out to take a life, you have to have ensured heightened reliability of the process. So what you have is an intersection, or rather a clash, between a death penalty prosecution and a national security interest that's been put forth in terms of as to why these accounts of conditions and these accounts of different experiences and detention, treatment, interrogation methods are not allowed to be aired out other than in a top secret clearance. And so from a mitigation perspective, a perfect example would be basically anything is allowed in mitigation and extenuation to mitigate a death sentence. To the extent, as a capital counsel, you are unable to develop that line of examination or that line of defense, it really is an effective assistance to counsel, and it really is actually a very good issue on appeal. So while we're very upset from a representational aspect, that we can't get into those types of experiences with the public or with human rights organizations, I can't even confirm to you that that's in fact something that's happened, right?
But the issue just narrowly, though, so if you could use it for purposes of mitigation, it'll just be that the detainees won't be able to speak about them in the courtroom. You could, I mean, assume for the moment that you could get them in as mitigation. You can get them in. It just can't take place either in an open court setting by the detainees testifying, for example. You'd have to play, you know, be filtered or something like that into a suitable unclassified form, or go into some sort of closed session.
You're correct. We could present that evidence in a classified setting, but here's the real kicker. What we can't do is use that information from the detainee, share it with an outside entity or somebody that we would consider that would be able to assist us in developing a line of defense. We can't take that account, independently investigate it, and then develop additional mitigation, additional mitigators or attenuators. Mm-hmm. A perfect example of that would be, for example, if we wanted to try and develop, and this is totally hypothetical, if we wanted to develop anything having to do with the conditions in foreign countries or foreign courts, or have a foreign country issue some kind of ruling that evidence ought not to be used because it was obtained under conditions that were completely against their domestic law. We can't do that because we can't even talk about whether there are foreign countries where there were domestic laws that are violated in different countries. So while we can present limited experiences in our court, we cannot develop them even further as we would like to be able to develop them outside of that to then present in court. So that's where the real problem comes in. And I can tell you we're going to be filing a motion an ex parte that lays out for the court all of the impediments that we have to developing that information and what we would do if we were allowed to sit down and talk to human rights organizations, to talk to other countries about the problems, if there were any problems in their domestic or the European Court of Human Rights, those types of things.
Okay. One just final note. A big issue right now is the hunger strike ongoing at Guantanamo, which now counts as members, I think 102 detainees. You would know better than I. But it's been reported that intermittently, at least your client has been among them. The hunger strike provoked the president, or question about it provoked the president during a press conference. He apparently is experiencing a kind of resurgence of enthusiasm for the Guantanamo closure project. Where do you see all of this going, I guess, is what I'm interested in. The hunger strike seems to gain momentum, but the president's been criticized for essentially for a kind of ambivalence about really doing something about Guantanamo, sort of talking about out of two sides of his mouth about closing it, but then you have congressional restrictions and his own policies. Where do you see this all going?
I think there will probably be a middle ground where I think we will see a segment of the detainee population or the prisoner population that will be moved. I think very recently you saw the discussion about the Yemeni defendants, the Yemeni prisoners. I think there's 56 of them. And if the administration had self-imposed, I guess, a ban on sending them back to Yemen, we could see movement on that end. I do not think necessarily that type of action would require congressional approval. Mm-hmm. And I think the Attorney General may have said that as well, and talked about that. And then you have an additional 36, I believe, 30 who have been cleared for release, who could be arguably repatriated. Of course, the two things that I would point out for you, which are just facts, in terms of the administration's willingness to take action that is consistent with the rhetoric, is number one, the amount of money that they've asked for to continue to operate Guantanamo is in the millions and millions of dollars. And I've got some numbers here because I couldn't remember the numbers, but I think the numbers are that in terms of the you're talking about $79 million just for the detention operations. $20.5 million for the Office of Military Commissions. That's an increase from $12.6 million before to run the Office of Military Commissions, which includes the Prosecutor's Office, includes the Defense's Office, and includes also the Convening Authority's Office. Then you've got $40 million for a fiber optic cable that I think was also in the request, and $90 million for operation and maintenance. $200 million for construction and upgrade, and at last count, the best estimate was that we spend about $800,000 per year to keep one Guantanamo prisoner in Guantanamo. So we continue to go to Congress, we continue to ask for money, and the administration continues to seek money to operate the prison. Second point is that Daniel Freed, who was a special envoy, who was the person in the Obama administration who was tasked with repatriating many of these prisoners, he changed over in, I think it was January of this year, I believe, he left that office and was never replaced. There was never any indication that he would be replaced. But he was responsible for helping to repatriate, I believe it was in excess of 30 prisoners. That position was never filled, and that he moved on to some other position with the State Department. But those kinds of concrete actions, I think, would signal that the administration is serious if they were to signal that in terms of economically, and also in terms of actually appointing someone whose primary duty and responsibility would be to look for a way to get some of these men home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think those are two real important points to look at the hunger strike. In terms of Mr. Al-Hassawi, that you are correct, he has refused food now for a lengthy period of time. And this is nothing new. It's just that this issue has come to the forefront. It's gotten a lot of attention. But I can tell you that since I've been representing him for the past 3 years, this is something that he's engaged in terms of peacefully protesting the conditions and some of the things that he sees as being inconsistent with the type of conditions for detention that we should have. And that many other prisoners have actually done this as well in the past. And I think what you've seen is just a natural evolution with more time that has passed, the more lack of action from the administration. And you've just seen more and more people just take on that, just taking momentum in terms of doing that. But certainly, I think JTF Gitmo has a certain criteria that they use when they qualify somebody as a strike, and it has to do with the number of meals that they take or the number of meals that they miss.
Consecutively refuse or something.
Something along those lines. I'm not exactly sure what that formula is, but what I know is that many men have been refusing to eat for a while. And I think an important point to also remember is that when they refuse to eat, they don't want to accept food from people that they believe are treating them in a way that they ought not to be treating them. So So, for instance, if I come and I bring some food for Mr. Hassawi, he will generally accept that. And he will generally take food that I bring in for a meeting with him. And sometimes I'll do that. And we'll share tea or we'll share some other meal. But that's directly related to the kind of relationship that you have, the respect and the trust in the relationship that you have. It just, it's a general reaction that you, if somebody is doing or treating you in a manner that you think is inconsistent with the kind of treatment that you should receive or the dignity or respect that you should receive, they're not going to take anything from them. And that's really what it translates into. And I think it's worthwhile to also highlight that there really hasn't been any violent action or any real violent actions on behalf of when you're taking these protests. Certainly Mr. Al-Hassawi has not done that. And I think this is just desperation for many of these men in terms of having been held there for years. Now, I don't know most of them. I don't represent the vast majority of them. I have one client that I represented for 3 years, one before that. But we talk to other lawyers, and there is some communication within the camps. And so that's generally what is that. The other part of that, I think, that if the administration takes a really look at the I can't remember the name of the office, but it's I can't remember the office within the Department of Defense, but it's the Undersecretary of Defense for Detainee Affairs. The Undersecretary of Defense for Detainee Affairs for years has been in charge of detainee relations. And then we call them prisoners because they don't like being called detainees. They're prisoners. They feel like they're prisoners in prison. But for many years, we've written letters to the Undersecretary of Defense for Detainee Affairs that have gone unanswered, literally unanswered. And that's in excess of half a dozen letters. Some of them were in a classification level that was heightened because we were operating under the scheme back then where you had the presumptive classification. So some of them we sent on the high side. But the general topic of these letters was, look, these are condition issues, these are detention issues, these are law for detention issues that we think we need to address. It would certainly help, and one of the bases that we put in there is that it would help facilitate relationships between the guard force and the detainees, the captor and the captive. If you meet them halfway and if you look at some fairly legitimate issues that they had. But the reality is that was never, ever answered. And I think you saw in our letter to Secretary Hagel that we talked about that, the lack of responsiveness. I think if somebody's looking for why this got to where it's gotten, that's certainly one of the things that they would have to look at.
Walter, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Lawfare podcast, produced in collaboration with the Brookings Institution. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.